She's got a smile that'll melt your heart. She's always there to lend a helping hand. Her fantasy knowledge is just the start. Her skills are highly in demand. She's our Bay Area lady out there hustling for us. Advice that we really trust. Bay Area lady, always there to help. She's not a cone, she's your favorite gal. She's to find you bell.
Hello and welcome into another edition of the Answering the Bell podcast. I'm very excited about my guest today and the topic that we're going to cover, because this is something different for us. It involves sports that we haven't covered on this podcast before, and a topic that's always of interest to me, yet unique in that we have not talked about it related to this sport. So I'm here with Daniel Dopp, my producer extraordinaire.
Oh, hey, Stefania.
Yeah. Hey, Daniel. Daniel likes to join me for these because he always learns. I think you're going to learn a lot today. This is very cool.
I hope so, because I canceled a really cool Dungeons & Dragons game in order to be here for this. So,
wow. You really don't have a life. Okay. Moving on. I want to waste no time getting to my guest today, Dr. John Nidecker, who is the vice president of the Association of the Ringside Physicians. And he's also the lead author of their consensus statement on concussion management in combat sports. And I'll talk a little bit more about what that means. But Dr. Nidecker is a sports medicine physician with Orthopedic Specialists of North Carolina in Raleigh, and he specializes in sports-related concussion, non-operative orthopedics, and treats athletes of all ages in a variety of sports. He's also assistant professor at Campbell University and a team physician for the Milwaukee Brewers minor league team, the Carolina Mudcats. So without further ado, and oh, I'll mention this, don't hold it against him. He is a longtime loyal listener of the 06010 podcast and an avid fantasy football player.
Yes. Like this guy already.
Yeah, exactly. So, Dr. Nidecker, welcome.
Thank you for having me. It's an absolute delight to be, you know, talking to you guys. I almost forgot I was on the call. I was like listening to the podcast with listening to the two of you talk. So,
well, you're going to make us all smarter today. I appreciate you joining us. First of all, I just want to start by saying you are osteopathically trained, and not everyone who listens might be familiar with how that is different from a traditional MD degree. Perhaps you could elaborate.
Yeah, I'd be happy to elaborate on that. In the United States, there's basically two medical degrees that are given to physicians. That's MD, medical doctor, and DO, which is doctor of osteopathic medicine. When the first two degrees were created, there was a very big difference in what the education was. As time has gone on, things have merged to where now, even over the last year, the medical education has pretty much come under one umbrella, or is starting to do that. I think the biggest difference in the medical schools between MD and DO is the philosophy that is taught. With DOs, there's a high there's a big emphasis on primary care. Mm-hmm. So many DOs end up going into primary care subspecialties. They also family practice, pediatrics, OBGYN, things like that. That doesn't mean that a DO cannot specialize in something, or an MD cannot become a family practice doctor. It's just, it's the curriculum that kind of guides the medical student into those types of fields. You know, we're kind of, in osteopathic medicine, we're kind of trained to look at the patient as a whole and encompass everything, not just their medical problem, but, you know, the other things that may be influencing the problem, whether it be the psychosocial issues that could be involved in any kind of condition.
And now you also then have specialized as an osteopathic physician in sports.
That's correct. So I'm board certified in family practice and sports medicine. So my initial training was in family practice, and then I went on to do a sports medicine fellowship. So people with my background do operate in different types of medicine. Some are family practice docs that are, you know, just savvy in sports. Some, you'll find many people with my background who work at major universities and kind of oversee all the athletics from their injuries to their illnesses. And then what's becoming more and more common nowadays is that orthopedic practices are hiring physicians like myself to take care of a lot of the non-operative orthopedic issues. Mm-hmm. But also, you know, with that comes a lot of sports medicine. So there's a lot of sports concussion that also gets added into that. And that's a major part of my practice as well.
Right. And then you do, you know, the equivalent of sideline coverage in the combat sports. You have provided medical coverage for boxing, kickboxing, mixed martial arts. This is a particular interest of yours. And I know when we've talked in the past, you told me that you were a wrestler growing up in your youth. You grew up in Long Island. You used to go to some fights in the garden. Is that how you developed your interest in combat sports?
Yes, it starts as a little kid with my dad taking me to boxing matches at Madison Square Garden. And then, as you know, back then, you know, MMA wasn't a thing. But as it became more and more prevalent with the strong basis in wrestling that many, you know, MMA fighters have, it was just a natural gravitation for me to understand it and enjoy it because of the grappling aspect of it, and as well as the striking. So I naturally fell in love with MMA right away as well.
Now, how do you become a ringside physician, or how did you become one?
That was part of persistence and part luck. When I was a medical student in New Jersey, I went to Rowan School of Osteopathic Medicine in South Jersey. That's when the UFC was really starting to hit its stride. And I was like, this is really cool. This is something I would maybe want to cover as a physician, because I knew I was going to do sports medicine. But this was something that I didn't even think about until like one day when I was watching a fight. So I called up the New Jersey State Athletic Commission. And
I love it.
You know,
like you just called them up, like you cold called them.
Yeah. And asked them if I, you know, how do I become a physician? And they kind of didn't understand. You know, I wasn't talking to anyone medical at the time. They're like, wait, you're not a doctor yet, but you will be, or you're not licensed. How do you know? They didn't understand it. And I felt like I wasn't getting anywhere, but I still kind of persisted. And then finally, one day, out of the blue, I got a call from Dr. Dominic Coletta, who's kind of ringside physician royalty and my mentor in all of this. And he said, "Who is it? Who are you? And what do you want?" So I kind of, you know, let him know who I was and what I wanted to do. And he's like, "Well, I'll tell you what. I have a fight this weekend down in Atlantic City. How about you come in and see what this is all about?" So, you know, the rest was history after that.
Well, it's really cool. And now, I mean, you're certainly very involved. You are on the board of the Association of Ringside Physicians, correct?
That's correct.
And a part of how we got here today is that I was alerted to this consensus statement document from the Association of Ringside Physicians on concussion management. Just to let folks know, this document was published in the British Journal of Sports Medicine in July of this year, 2018. And it definitely caught my attention because I had noticed when the NFL had published a similar document earlier in 2018. And at the time, they were the only professional league to have published in a peer-reviewed journal their concussion protocol. And I thought that was a really important step because it required it to be peer-reviewed, evidence-based. And it created some accountability for what the steps were in the concussion protocol. So as soon as I saw that this had been put forth by the Association of Ringside Physicians, I thought, wow, you know, here's a sport where, although I didn't know a lot of specifics about what concussion management was like, I felt like there was probably a lot of variability. I think I was correct on that, and I'll have you speak to that in a minute. But just to see that you guys were really outside of the NFL. This is the only group that I've seen that's done that. If you could explain a little bit about how this project came about.
Sure. So I think to explain how it came about, I think I need to give you maybe a little bit of background on the Association of Ringside Physicians mm-hmm. as well. So the Association of Ringside Physicians is a group that's made of primarily physicians and other healthcare related professionals whose main goal is to serve, protect, and educate all those involved in combat sports. It's primarily a United States organization, but we are international. About 10% of our members are from outside the United States. It's actually a fairly new organization officially. When it first came about was actually in 2014. Before that, it was the American Association of Professional Ringside Physicians, and it was more obviously American. It wasn't international, and it was more primarily geared towards boxing. So that organization kind of morphed into what the ARP is today. It's a great organization made of, you know, ringside physicians, and ringside physicians actually come from all different backgrounds. They're not just sports medicine doctors like myself. A lot of physicians that do ringside medicine do it because they love the sport. So there's a wide variety of different backgrounds. Dr. Coletta, who brought me into all of this, is actually an ER doctor.
That kind of fits.
Yeah. I even one of the best ringside doctors that I know is actually an OBGYN, and that doesn't make a lot of sense.
That is
When you learn ringside medicine, you know ringside medicine.
Right.
It's nice to have a sports medicine background. There's certainly things that I can take from my sports medicine background into the ring with me, but you know, it's a different sport, and I think we'll get into that a little bit later. So not everything that you do in traditional sports medicine necessarily applies. So we are really a resource for physicians and commissions for the best medical advice out there. So as the organization has grown, we've been trying to put more and more good content out. And one of the things that we felt was important, you know, especially with what's going around in sports medicine today, is that we really need to come out on concussion and give our best advice of what should be done in the realm of combat sports. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's the reason why this was decided on. We decided to submit it to the British Journal because that's the major journal where most of the big concussion consensus statements have been put out. The NFL put theirs out through them as well. This is a peer-reviewed process, so we're having experts in the field of concussion basically read our paper and, you know, giving basically the thumbs up that this is based on good sound medical knowledge that we currently have and fully endorse what we're recommending.
So there are a couple questions that come to mind off of that. The first one, and I think I'm asking this on behalf of what I suspect most sports fans would wonder, whether you're a fan of ringside sports or not, is why is concussion management important in sports where the goal is often to knock out the opponent? I mean, yes, you can have knockouts and that are not, blows to the head. You can have victories that are essentially not based on a blow to the brain. But this is certainly the striking is part of the sport, and so there's a little bit of I guess people are just wondering, how do you balance that in this sport where that's ultimately the goal?
Well, you're absolutely right in what you're saying. I think we need to be probably more stringent in our protocols and what we do compared to, you know, what a non-contact sport needs to do. You know, this, what you're saying is absolutely true. And since some people argue that, you know, what the objective of the sport is, it is head contact, is, and all intents and purposes, maybe giving somebody a concussion. So for that reason, I think, the guidelines do state this, that concussion management in combat sports needs to be held to a higher standard. All the guidelines that have been, you know, put out in journals are really more geared to non-combat sports. So we needed to take the best information that those statements have come out and the best studies on concussion that have come out from our non-combat sports and try and find a place in how they fit. But we also need to take into account the differences of the sport itself. And we took the best practices that were happening before the statement and also incorporated them into the statement. So it's almost a hybrid of the best of both worlds.
Now, in most, in most peer-reviewed documents, the idea is to bring forth the best evidence based on, you know, you're accumulating, you know, clinical expertise and clinical practice as well as literature. But my understanding is that the literature is a bit lacking in this area. Is that true, number one, and how did you resolve your statement if there was a lack of documented evidence in the literature to support the practices?
When it comes to combat sports, you're absolutely correct. There is not the plethora of information when it comes to football, for instance. So what we need to do is take what we can from those other sports and try and bring them in. So we definitely used the non-combat sports evidence in making our guidelines. But with what we were lacking with, you know, the evidence that we didn't have regarding studies in combat sports, we really based it on just expert opinion. So with our consensus statement, we had probably thousands of fight experience under the belt of all the authors of this statement, with even very prominent neurologists who have been involved in the other statements, like Bob Cantu and Barry Jordan, in developing these guidelines as well.
So you have this amazing collection of experts, and everybody who's involved has experience in the combat sports arena. I think one of the things that sort of blew me away when we talked before was what the protocol, if you can call it that, was prior to this document, and then some of the things that you established post, particularly with regards to return to sport. So can you outline for the folks who are listening what used to be the case in terms of how you determined how long an athlete would be out after suffering a concussion compared to what you're putting in place now?
So basically, what was in place, and unfortunately in some instances is still in place in a number of jurisdictions, is what we call the 30-60-90-day rule. So to explain that is that a fighter would be evaluated after their fight, and 30 days. So if they suffered a TKO, they would be given a 30-day suspension. If they suffered a knockout without loss of consciousness, they were given a 60-day suspension. And then if they were knocked out with loss of consciousness, they were given a 90-day suspension. Once the suspension was up, then they were allowed to return to the ring.
There's so many. I have to stop you right there before you tell me what was fixed, because it starts making me want to rattle off all the things that are so obviously wrong with that, which is number one, like, the loss of consciousness differentiator. We know that that doesn't necessarily, that there's a non-linear relationship between the loss of consciousness and the time to recover necessarily. I mean, we hear about people who have not experienced loss of consciousness, who've suffered concussions, who can have symptoms that string on for longer. And then also the notion that, and I think this is the biggest thing to me, that once the time for the suspension was almost like a punishment, like you're out for 60 days, but then you come back, and that there's this arbitrary timetable that's assigned to the athlete at the time of injury.
Very correct. I will say this, though. 15 years ago, when it came to football games, somebody got, quote, their bell rung. We checked on them, and, you know, 10 minutes later you said, are you good? And then we let them back in. So there's been improvements right. In all sports, I think.
Right,
so.
Right. I mean, we are not meant to single you out, but It's yes. just, I think it was shocking to me because of what we know now that, that at the time, and I have to imagine that's a burden on the ringside physician too. If under the way the rule was stated, you are making a declaration essentially at the time of the injury, a projection for how long you expect the athlete to require before they can return.
Yes. And the difficult thing is, I think our listeners are the listeners of the podcast have come to realize is that, you know, sometimes symptoms take some time to develop too. So you don't necessarily can make a call on something right then and there. And that was often what was done. And unfortunately sometimes is done now. So, so that's something to also take into account.
So now, with the new guidelines that are in the document, how is it different?
So the difference, the big difference, I think, that of our recommendations is not only are we recommending these time periods, we are also recommending that they need to be cleared by a physician who is educated and experienced in concussion management before that suspension is lifted. So that's we're still recommending the 30, 60, 90 days as a minimum. The covering ringside physician could even increase that if they wanted to. But also the fact that somebody needs a clearance from another physician who understands concussion management before they can get back in the ring is needed as well.
In other words, you don't just show up at 30 days. You have to, in advance of that 30 days, be cleared by a physician with experience in concussion management.
Correct.
So here, go ahead.
The other thing that we also came out in this statement is a gradual stepwise progression of return to play that you hear about in all the sports. The only thing is we've recommended that they string it out a little bit longer. So we have like a three phase process of what we recommend. And it's more or less a return to fitness, a return to non-contact combat sports activity, and then a return to sparring. Mm-hmm. So we actually outline how some athletes should spar after they suffer concussion as well. And then once they're through that completion of that return to fight protocol, then we think it would be okay for the clearing physician to let them get back in competition.
I have so many things I want to follow up on, but let me start with, because you just brought up this return to sport protocol, kind of these three different phases. Who's taking the athlete through these phases typically? Because, you know, it's the one comparison that I think everybody is sort of familiar with now because we've talked about it so much is the NFL. So if you have an athlete in the NFL who has suffered a concussion, we know that they have essentially, it's different for each team, but essentially five phases of this return to play protocol. And it's starting with, you know, the light aerobic activity, and they're doing a little bit more, maybe drills and so on and so forth. It's a progression, like you describe. But we know who's taking them through that. They've got athletic trainers. They've got medical staff. They maybe work with some local folks who are experienced in concussion management who are helping bring the athletes back. But it's supervised. What's happening in the case of these fighters?
You're bringing up the big elephant in the room here. So that's the problem when it comes to combat sports. It is very, gym dependent. So it really depends where this fighter is coming from. So they may be coming from a gym that has a lot of resources that are available. Some big MMA gyms have strength and conditioning coaches and athletic trainers that are employed by that gym to help fighters get back from injuries and train correctly. So some gyms do have some type of healthcare professional that's available to those fighters that train at that gym. Unfortunately, the vast majority, that is not the case. So what a way that you can get around this is that, you know, once a fighter has been concussed in a fight, their next job is to more or less get in with a physician to help guide them through this process and help their coaches guide them through the return to sport process. That's probably the best way that this can be done at this point in time until some changes are made.
It's interesting. I'm sure that's going to be, you know, as you say, it's going to be a challenge for some athletes who will be in an area where the resources may be limited. And not only the resources in terms of what they're able to do and personnel, but just in terms of people's familiarity with concussion management, period, I would imagine.
Yes. Yes.
And that's just, it's just going to take time, but at least the outline for the parameters is now there. I'm also curious about, you said it, you know, the implementation has been, it's sort of a work in progress. And maybe you could explain for folks, because when I was trying to learn about this, this was an education for me, is about how the different commissions run and how documents like what you've presented here get implemented. And it's different. It's not universally adopted across the country. It's got, every state has its own rules, correct?
That's correct. So every state has its own rules. Every, you know, with the reservations, the different reservations have their own commissions as well. The different countries have their own commissions. Some countries don't even have commissions. So it really depends on where you're at, on what happens for events. Commission's main job basically is to make sure that events that occur in their jurisdiction happen safely and ethically. Now, how that happens is really up to the commission. So that goes from not just how things are done medically, but also how things are done logistically. So, you know, when are weigh-ins going to happen? How many, you know, based on the venue, how much security are you going to need? You know, so there's things that different commissions decide outside the medical as well. Some commissions are very organized and some commissions are very laid back. Some commissions actually assign the physicians to the events. So they're the physicians in certain states are actually more or less commission employees. And, you know, when an event happens, the commission assigns a physician to that event. And in some states, it's actually up to, you know, it's up to the promoter to provide a physician to cover that event. So things are drastically different in how things happen from state to state, even when it comes to fighter licenses too. So most fighters need some type of blood work to make sure they don't have any infectious disease in most jurisdictions like HIV and right. hepatitis. But some states require a fighter to have a baseline brain scan, whether it's CT or MRI, in their jurisdiction as well. So the variability.
That's interesting.
Yes.
Because as we know, that could show some things, but there's a number of things that would not reflect, including some persistent concussion related symptoms.
Correct. The one thing that I can say that may be helpful in is you have somewhere to start. So if somebody ends up getting a scan in the future for some type of injury, you can compare it
right.
and see if there's any changes. So that is helpful. But depending on where it's done, there's so many differences in what even happens before a fight, let alone what happens after a fight.
Now, I know that you had told me that New York was one of the states that has adopted the recommendations from this document. How did that come about, and have you seen any changes as a result of them adopting this document?
Truth be told, they were actually following these guidelines before the statement came out. So,
oh, wow.
They were already doing this practice of physician clearance in addition to day suspension. So things haven't changed much there. It's just given them, you know, documentation that they're doing the right, you know, right thing. There are organizations that are doing this as well too. So I know in working UFC fights, this is something that the UFC has implemented. They make sure that their fighters who have sustained some type of head injury are cleared by a neurologist or a sports medicine doctor before they're allowed to return the ring. They have the resources, the athletic trainers, to help take their fighters who are under UFC contract to get them through things as well, too. So even though, say, an injury happened in North Carolina, you know, those guys are taken care of, but that's the vast minority of things too. As far as since the statement has come out and other states have actually adopted this, I actually haven't heard of any making it policy.
Really?
Having said that, yes. Having said that, it's very difficult to change policy when you're dealing with these state commissions because, and often for rules to change, they actually need to be voted on by state legislature. So
people who have nothing to do with medicine, who may have no medical background, who may not understand it, but they, because it's the state legislature, they control the commission. They get to vote on whether the policy is implemented.
In certain instances, yes.
That's
some state legislatures give their commissions a lot more latitude than that, though. Sometimes they, you know, in certain jurisdictions, the commission has the authority to change rules without, you know, without the blessing of the state legislature. In some cases, not. Like I said, it's so different from state to state.
That's got to be so challenging. Have you encountered any resistance? In other words, people who say, look, I know it's going to make it harder for me to potentially come back or my athletes to potentially come back if we have to go through this this process, this red tape, these hoops to get back in the ring after an injury that, frankly, is likely to occur on any in any given bout. Has there been any resistance?
The good news is no. I did present these guidelines at the Association of Boxing Commissions, which is a different organization, that their conference. That's basically a group that all the commissions belong to, and the charge of that group is to make recommendations, whether or not the commissions end up following it. That's another story, but they have a conference each year where they present various different topics. There's often a lot of medical that's involved. And I presented this to basically the majority of commissioners from the United States. And all I got, all I received was, you know, that was really good information. We need to be doing this. I think it makes sense. I mean, we're requiring high school football players in, I think, pretty much every state nowadays to get cleared by a physician or some healthcare professional before they're allowed to get back on the field after a concussion. Why aren't we doing it for combat sports? So I think just the common sense aspect of it, that's why we haven't met any pushback.
Well, I'd like to think that common sense will prevail. It'd be interesting to sort of monitor how this progresses and how it gets adopted around the country. I wanted to steer a little bit towards a fight that's happening this week. This is the Holloway-Ortega fight that's on December 8th. So we're recording this on, what is today, December 5th. So this is upcoming. And I think it's of interest because Holloway was forced to withdraw from a fight in April after having some trouble during a weight cut. And then July was experiencing some concussion-like symptoms, I think is how it was worded. And, you know, the reactions were varied, depending on who you talk to, including his opponent at the time, who I think has since regretted some of the remarks. But what do you make of this as sort of the reaction in the MMA world and just how it all came out? And do you think the guidelines being in place like they are now would change how this type of thing goes forward in the future, how this, what the outcome is in the future?
First and foremost, I don't know if the guidelines had any effect on it, but I do believe the guidelines were followed in this case.
Mm-hmm.
It's a bizarre case in itself, and the details have really yet to be explained, and I'm not even sure if they really understand what happened. From my understanding, Max Holloway was exhibiting some signs and symptoms of concussion pretty much like the week before or week of his fight with Ortega. I think that was back in July.
Mm-hmm.
And because of that, that fight was canceled. So, you know, our guidelines are stating that, you know, if a concussion is suspected, you know, that combat sports athlete should be pulled from competition until they're cleared. He had, from my understanding, $1 million workup of multiple tests and even some toxicology things that, from what has been reported, has all been negative. From a concussion standpoint, I think it's an interesting teaching point for many, in the sense that, you know, when somebody has a concussion, they can have one symptom, they can have 20. And a lot of these concussion symptoms overlap with other medical conditions. So I think when you were talking to Dr. Sills, just because about the NFL policy, just because somebody is put in concussion protocol doesn't mean they necessarily have a concussion.
Right.
So that's essentially what happened with Holloway. He got put in concussion protocol. They worked him up. They tried to figure out what was going on. Everything came up negative in that could have been possibly done. And they basically ruled out a concussion or any other significant medical condition that would prevent him from fighting. And here we are, you know, fight week.
I think, well, you know, and I look forward, I hope this one, you know, that everything goes as planned. It'd be interesting to hear from him after this fight. One thing that I noticed in some of the commentary from other fighters after is you heard some fighters talking about how they've had similar symptoms and they've gone through with their fights before and haven't spoken about it. I mean, this is not unique to this culture. This sounds like NFL football, to be honest. But you know what I'm saying, that the fighters are trying to hide it because payday depends on fighting. They know everybody is going through similar things. How do you work to change that culture?
I think it's just exposure. I think this podcast certainly helps. I think, you know, continuing to talk to our fighters, continuing to talk to commissions, you know, that's the only way that things are going to change. You saw it in the NFL. I mean, you may say things aren't perfect with the NFL, but they're certainly better. And you know, the culture is certainly changing in that way. We now have, you know, players retiring because they're concerned about their health in regards to things where, you know, policies and procedures have been improved. I think what the NFL has done has certainly decreased the chance of any significant problems. I don't think it's necessarily, you know, eliminated the chances of, you know, things, but it certainly has made things better. And a lot of that has to do with, you know, the player education. I think some of these players have really taken this to heart and they understand the significance of these injuries nowadays.
Absolutely. I definitely think there's been a culture shift in the NFL, and it's still, you know, it's still a work in progress, but I think that's to be understood. I find it fascinating in the fight world just because, you know, in the NFL, one of their goals is they're literally changing, making rule changes to try and avoid head contact. I don't see that happening as a part of fighting because there is strategy around that.
Absolutely correct. I think we just need to improve how we go about improving how we return fighters back from injuries and also improving recognizing injuries in fighters that, you know, were, for all intents and purposes, you know, the warrior culture, you know, biting down on the mouthpiece and just pushing through. So I think as time goes on, I'm hoping that we will see these same changes in combat sports.
Well, I really appreciate you taking the time to share this with us and with the audience today. I think this is fascinating. Like, I, for one, am going to be watching really closely in the combat sports world to see what happens if you do have a fighter with a head injury and sort of how they're managed and what steps they're going through to return, knowing that these guidelines have been put out there, been disseminated, that people are being educated on this. And hopefully, as these athletes are learning that they have to, yes, you know, you choose to get into a collision or a combat sport, you know that there are inherent risks, but you also can be smart about how you work to return from injury. And hopefully the folks taking care of them are doing the same thing. So thank you very much for joining me today.
Oh, my pleasure. And we'll put the Association of Ringside Physicians will keep on putting good content out as long as you guys keep on putting good fantasy content out.
Oh, well. We have to start then. Thanks very much, Dr. Nidecker.
All right. Take care, guys.
Well, big thanks to Dr. John Nidecker. Very enlightening information related to the state of concussion management in the world of combat sports and doing yeoman's work. These folks trying to basically take a sport where there were not a lot of documented regulations related to particularly return to sport for these athletes after they suffered a concussion, and trying to at least get some baseline elements in place so that there's consistency. That's what I take away from it, that they're trying to establish a baseline so that there's some form of consistency within the sport and something that states can, you know, default to as sort of like the minimal expectation.
Right.
In an effort to get really this concussion management up to speed with what we're seeing in other sports.
Yeah, one of the things that I thought was really interesting was the way that you talked about how there was a 30, 60, and 90-day window based on a TKO, a knockout without loss of consciousness, and a knockout with loss of consciousness. And it just seems understanding they're trying to make changes, and they are. It just seems so archaic to think that, like, concussions are not linear. It's not a 30, 60, 90-day window. So
what's so interesting is that this comes from the old school. If you go back into the international concussion consensus documents, concussions used to be graded. Now, you know, anybody who listens to the OSX, knows how I feel about this, because currently there is not a grading scale that is universally accepted when it comes to concussions.
Right.
In the olden days, in the first iterations of this document, there used to be grades assigned to concussions, with severity being attributed to loss of consciousness. Not unlike what's implied here, where a longer time off is required for suspension based on loss of consciousness. And people who work in the world of concussion now understand that loss of consciousness does not dictate recovery time. We've seen people have loss of consciousness and return to normal within 7 to 10 days. And we've seen people never lose consciousness and have post-concussion symptoms that linger for weeks or months. So yes, the time suspension is arbitrary, but I think what Dr. Nidecker would want people to know is that as the ringside physician, he can put into place whatever he feels is the correct way to approach return to sport for that athlete, even if the state hasn't upgraded their policies to be consistent with this document yet. So, for example, he can write, he has to go by these suspension timelines that are his choices in terms of at least at the minimum a 30-day or the minimum a 60-day.
Right, right.
But he can say, and requires clearance from a physician with experience in concussion management before the athlete can return to the ring. I think that is really important because it gives the people with the expertise the ability to write some criteria into that return to sport.
Absolutely. And even as a part of that, you know, when you guys were talking about it, Dr. Nidecker said, you know, if you look at 10 years ago, the NFL was in the same position where they were trying to figure everything out. And so obviously it's catching up, and we have people that are trying to do work to be able to get this into a better place. So, you know, the parallels there, it's just interesting to me that a sport doesn't change overnight.
No.
Things don't change overnight. You know, you got to take the time to be able to do this. I did think it was interesting the way that he was talking about how, you know, so each state sort of has its own commission. And so he can be, you know, somebody from South Carolina or North Carolina or Georgia can decide, all right, well, this, you know, fighter has a minimum of 30 days or 60 days. And even though there's not a universal across the board, you know, a national commission, that other state, if the fighter is from Oklahoma or the fighter is from North Dakota, they have to honor what it is that was set forth by the doctor.
I think that's important. So as he said, New York has been implementing these guidelines for a period of time before they were even out with these official guidelines from the Association of Ringside Physicians. So if they would document New York, a player suffered a concussion, they document it as a TKO, or let's say a TKO with a 30-day suspension, and they write in and clearance, blah, blah, blah. If that fighter seeks to fight in another state where they may not have that policy in place approved by the commission in that state, they will honor the state in which that document was written. And apparently there's an electronic database that these things get put into. So if you are in Nevada, you can see what has happened when the fighter had this fight in New York, and the documentation is inserted by these physicians. So it's nice to know that that information is available to everyone, and that they operate sort of that's a code of honor thing, I believe. But it'd be nice, it'd be even better, when all these states get on board. And it seems common sense, right? Why wouldn't you want to upgrade your policies?
Yeah, but a standardized baseline for everybody, so we're all playing by the same rules and everyone knows everything, and it's just...
But then again, this is combat sports, and there have been some challenges in that department for things other than healthcare reasons. So, look, Like, I will say this. This is impressive to me. The Association of Ringside Physicians, only the second group to bring forth a concussion document and have it published in a peer-reviewed journal.
Absolutely.
The only other group that's done that is the NFL. MLB hasn't done it. NBA hasn't done it. MLS hasn't done it. NHL hasn't done it. And even though they have all implemented some different concussion protocols that exist within the organization, MLB established that concussion 7-day DL window. There are things that have been done, but to publish in a peer-reviewed journal is a totally different level of exposing yourself and saying, here's what we think, here's what evidence we have to come to this conclusion, and then it's reviewed. The reviewers are blinded to the people who are contributing the content, and essentially they can redline through it what they like and don't like. They can tell them to come back with more evidence. It really is sort of putting yourself out there, and I commend this group for doing that and taking that step, because it's an important first step to having any credibility when it comes to concussion management in combat sports.
Absolutely. This was great, Stefania.
Well, thank you, Daniel.
Yeah, I enjoyed this one.
Yeah, I'm glad you did. I hope that the audience did as well. And thank you for listening to another edition of Answering the Bell. And we hope to continue these with more interesting topics. And as we get out of NFL season, we're kind of coming to the end of that. We will be covering lots of interesting topics in football and other sports as well. And until then, stay healthy.